is Himani Banerjee. Himani lives in Toronto at the moment and came to Canada in 1969. She teaches in the social science department at York University, and she's a writer of poetry and short stories. Thank you, Himani.
Okay, what I have to say this afternoon may not directly come from the context of themes and images that has been set up through the conference. And the fact that I'm speaking about issues that may not be of immediate concern to you may to some extent disempower what I have to say. But I still think that you will feel some kind of connection between what I am saying and what has been said so far, because what I speak about is also about power and desire. And by desire, I mean sexuality, but in general also our relationship with the world that makes us feel open enough, free enough to be vulnerable and to let the world come into us as much as we want to go into the world. That open living relationship with what is going on all the time as authentic subjects of our own experience is what I would like to call desire. And that includes all aspects of our life that are growing, positive, and affirming. Now, I want to begin by reading two poems in the context of which what I have to say, which is quite prosaic after that, interspersed with a couple more poems, will follow. And the one poem I'm reading in the beginning has to do with some of what we have seen in these video images and the discussions that have been presented is this commoditization, the trivia, the banality that is choking us to death, killing desire in people. And it's called Death by Trivia. Let me see if I can find it. I'm not the most prepared of persons. Is the microphone all right? I mean, can you hear? In these days, there is no big living for us. Grand emotions, curtains rising and falling with a thunderous applause. No ultimate moment of the last surrender, commitment that permits no going back up the stairs, when we could say, I will not live without you, or loving means this or that. And when the moment comes, apply the aspic to our breast. We cannot turn to someone and pour out all that knowledge we got by ingesting so many deaths. We have chewed so long on so many deaths that we have grown fat as maggots in the world's coffin. These are days that are small, with fine steel teeth in their edges. They're grinding us down. They're filing away at us. Our vows are tentative, shamefaced, murmured below our breaths, often heard, always at the fine point of retraction. We have loosened our arms around eternity, which alone could have given our lives that finely sculpted shape. Looking into someone's endless eyes, the tired lines around the mouth, looking at the lights across the river, the sad outline of the bridge that joins nothing with nowhere. We could have spoken words to each other with the sad, solemn intonation of bells. We could have. We could wish to have spoken the ultimate, could have marked the moment in the exquisite calligraphy of a testament. All this could have been, but at another time, when time was marked by peaks, not successions. In this serialized time with nothing, no signs, no words, we are careful and banal. I did not tell you that I had eaten on death or that forever was possible. We covered ourselves in bed under the patchwork quilt. We spoke trivia. We smoked a few cigarettes. I drank a glass of water. You fell asleep and turned to me with your eyebrows knitted, your left hand open. You groped for something. But I did not put my hand in yours, for what you sought lay elsewhere, perhaps in childhood. I lay there in the light sleep of nomadic people. Time passed, one thought melted into another. No will for permanence, only a sudden impulse to pray to a God that does not exist. For me, for you, for all of us to be forgiven for our inability to will, to make meanings beyond the moment, to love, for our slow suicide, for our death by trivia. So you get the drift. It's not pleasant. Kind of bleak. It's hard to be pleasant in a hard world. The other poem I'm reading is directly in the context also of what I'm going to talk about. It is about my Canadian experience. You know, when you come to Canada as immigrant people, they ask you, do you have Canadian experience? Well, this is about Canadian experience, but it's a general experience of Canada quintessentially, which to me is represented by the Canadian winter. It's called Canada in winter. The snow cannot hide the blood anymore. The woman is dying. She counts the pavements, counts steps, counts wounds, counts time. In the car tracks, teeth in the snow, the shadow lengthens, intensifies. The wind, hair in the mouth, in the eye, blood trails, drops of snow, blood under the gas lamps. The wind, torn wings, leaves feathers in the bush. An ambulance rushes with the predator's howl. Everywhere, millions are dying. Now, the piece that I have here, that I have thought through as best as I can for now, is about images and visibility of us who are called the visible minorities. And it is called Now You See Them, Now You Don't, on the visibility-invisibility dialectic of the image of South Asian women. There are three things that I think you can see become noticeable when you start looking seriously in your world of about images of South Asian women. First, you won't find many. As a whole, there's generally a lack of visual images. Doesn't mean there aren't others. Two, that there is an absolute lack of positive image of any kind of the communities as a whole, women in particular. Three, a presence of images that are not only negative, but absolutely petrifying and grotesque, that are presented, for instance, in images of sexuality of South Asian women by the pornography industry if they pick up the Japanese women and so on to represent them. So these are the three things you notice, and the absence and the presence of the types of women, of the images of women, are actually, I claim, connected at the base and originate in the same imperialist, racist, sexist practices of this state, economy, and the everyday life of people, the way it's organized through them. Now, these images are about power and about aiming to create powerlessness in people. And from this point of view, there are three things that I personally noticed, and that these images are can be, that generally when one talks about images of people, they can be divided as images and images. You know, that's, the problem is not that one is represented. The problem is how one is represented. Now, there are images that are images of what I call prescription and ascription, telling you who you should be, who you are, from those who have the authorial right to say so. And there are images of description by us seeing how people live, showing how people live in their everyday life. There are images of resistance that people put up when they are fighting their ascriptive practices and therefore images of our lives. Now, they are generated obviously by different sorts of persons in different social locations and for different purposes. The first are generated by the ruling classes and their hangers-on for the purpose of ruling, and the second by those whom the first images are sought to be made about, that is, the people themselves make either the descriptive images or resistance descriptive images. Now, these people who'd make the resistance descriptive images try to show us that they never really were who the images of the rulers said they were. And they never really were completely subsumed. They, however, do not control the conventional channels of image making, which are controlled by and accessed by the rulers and others that are close to them. Then they resort to forms that are generally invisible to others outside of their immediate, they resort to forms that are invisible to others and in their own immediate world, because the means of mechanical reproduction and are in the hands of those who are socially and economically dominant over them. However, any crisis situation actually will bring out some of the images that people make for themselves and about themselves, and some of the practices and techniques of image making that they have, and they're generally discovered then by the ruling class as an image making or a culturally productive community. This has been the case in Britain with the black youth, for instance, after the Brixton riots. Four or five years ago, there's a plethora of discoveries about the fact that they too can have their culture, they too make their images. So that's one thought I had about this. The other one is that these images are about how people should live, you know, the type that are ascriptive, and if you want to simply put it that there are images that come which are descriptive that tell us how we should do live and should live, you know, that what and how we want to live, and that one has to make a very firm distinction between the two. The lines don't overlap. Now, The other issue I have here that struck me while thinking about images is that there's the great difficulty of arguing from images to life, rather than from life to images, which a friend of mine I was talking to pointed out to me. Now, putting aside for the time being that the images that are churned out by the reproductive system of the mainstream media, there is still a problem of trying to figure out what a group of people are, even in resistance, only from the images alone. Because images do have a way of falling into a coding system. So they do say what they say, but while they say what they say, they often do not say what else could be said, unless they are very, very specialized kind of images that refer out rather than in, into a closed or locked system. Now, that I found to be quite interesting, because whereas the images offered of us by the racist media, for instance, are extremely unidimensional, and therefore you would have no sense of us as people, as an autonomous beings of any kind from that, nor would you actually from some types of representations of us, which are done in a well-meaning way, as completely dominated people, because we are not, you know, dominated. Nobody is entirely a victim. I mean, system has not managed to, fortunately, incorporate all of us entirely into it. The world is still not a multinational corporation in its entirety. So it is difficult, I think, to argue entirely from within images, because of this kind of encoding that goes into creating a sort of a coherent system, but the system doesn't promote some other kinds of things in it. But the very fact that images or words, for that matter, can be detached and inserted into other systems makes us think about images in an even more complex way, because there are images that are in and off of themselves not problematic at all, but they can be inserted in an ongoing kind of image discourse or other kinds of discourse within which they take on a horrifying power. And not the least of which, for instance, is the sign of swastika. Now, I come from India, where in Indian villages, where total non-knowledge exists about Nazism, the image of swastika is an image of beneficence, of auspiciousness, and of life. Now, that is no longer the case with me. I can no longer see swastika and not feel terrified by it, right? So this kind of insertion of images within an ongoing context of practices load certain images which might be quite innocuous in and off of themselves. The other type of images that I have found are images that are actually born on the terrain of ruling, of domination. And those I do not think are retrievable things at all. And so one cannot again, I mean, talking about images, come to such a simple conclusion of what means what in a simple coded system, because the code is not only referential within itself with a system of other related codes, but the code refers out into the world to the location, the matrix within which the image arises. So I felt that that was something that I noticed, and the swastika interested me because I come from a culture from where the swastika is still a living form. Now, as I said, what empowers images is what still goes on. You know, images gain their life and meaning in history, in the practice of our everyday life. This is why it is the most desirable thing, I think, and as this friend of mine pointed out, is to argue from life to the image rather than from the image to the life, which is why I began by reading these poems and talking about the conditions of domination within which we live, in which my poetry, other people's poetry, art arises. Finally, I think it is also difficult to gather meaning from anything, no matter who does it, solely from a body of coherence of any kind, because the structure of reality, it seems to me, from the experience I've had in being alive, is terribly contradictory. And that any kind of entire sealed, locked, seamless coherence prevents one from bringing in those other things which we are experientially aware of, but the discourse doesn't have any room for them, which leads to a kind of schizophrenia, which generates in us between the way we think about the world when we are, quote unquote, thinking without, you know, in those terms, like we recognizably know we are doing some thinking now, and the level at which our thinking goes on in a haphazard everyday way and living and feeling goes on. And we cannot find these systematic bodies of coherences, be they those of image or what have you, which are entirely unidimensional, have a way of coping with them. So I think that is something that one has to keep in mind. I have to when I think about images, our own or other people's. Now, I also want to say that by beginning from images then, since I pointed these things out, that images are of mind as well as of eyes and ear and everything. So images are solely not, in our case, for instance, as images of eyes. There are not that many images of South Asian women in your everyday life. But there are lots of, other than visual images, which are not there in great number, lots of images of the mind. And those images of the mind we call, or sociologists so evasively have called, stereotypes. And they remain there at the back of our head, and they can be summoned by even the youngest child when necessary, uttered and acted upon. So I felt that these images of mind and ear, verbal images and mental images of certain kinds, are related to the visual images and are different levels that we have to personally contend with. Now, the social and historical organization of images of South Asian women and South Asian people in general, then, must be understood from the relations of domination that make us absent from the general superstructure and relegates us a place at the lowest basement of social production as an extension of the work that we do or are supposed to do, the machinery that we use, the shifts that we work. Denied a real presence in the social space, we are also rendered faceless. No great plethora of visual images, as I said, exist about us or surround us, except the abundance of mental images or racist stereotypes that can always be summoned to create negative, degrading, and exploitable images when necessary. But generally, visibility is not what is demanded of us, those who are the visible minority. And I am interested in this theme of visibility because images are, in our context, about visibility. And this term itself requires some attention because we're classified as visible. Now, if you have a body, you exist in body, you are bound to be visible. unless you are a spiritual presence, there's no way one can be invisible. What can you, who are white members of this community, and think about yourselves as being visible people? Just try and think about identifying yourselves as visible people and see how that feels. And I think it will feel utterly absurd, you know. But yet this absurdity has been tagged as an adjective to our name, and it is our official institutional description, right? Now, what can this mean? What could they have meant by using the word visible for us? What imperatives are embedded in the word visible? If not that our images abound all over the place in visuals around you, which they do not. And I have a few guesses as to what this means. And I think that we were hitherto invisible. We had no real existence in our third world countries and in our poverty, slum, and overpopulation, and that we gain a body, become somebody in this promised land. Could it be that there is only, that is the only identity that we will ever be permitted to have in Canada? And that like children, we should be seen and not heard from? And that that our visibility is the only proof of our existence? And that we are supposed to be figures without depth, without a voice or a history or needs or demands? That is, in that visibility, is there also not only an admonition of silence, but a threat? That I can see you, saying as the voice of a racist, imperialist society, and which says, so keep to your place. The supervisor can say to the woman worker, you can't hide from me, I can see you, I'm keeping my ear to the ground to catch the faintest murmur of you organizing. The woman employer says to the black domestic worker that I can see that you are different from me and therefore you can do work that I find too heavy and obnoxious. That the sexually driven person can say to this woman, I can see that you are a pucky woman and you have a certain type of use for me. Or the cop saying, I know how to treat the likes of you pucky bitches. And these are, you know, so much I can say for benefits of visibility. Now, throughout the process, we are standing in the third degree light of this stream of stares you will see in our poetry, in writing by black people from the States and our writing here. This sort of light that streams out of stares of contempt, of dismissal, or exoticized tourism and plain sadism against the white wall of this Canadian society. And we ourselves actually want 100% invisibility in those times, that we do not want to be visible at all. It's not good for us. So we see visibility then not as a source of second level visual images for us. That is not even our problem, that we are represented visually terribly badly. But we see visibility as a device to create mental images, practical images, social images, in order to mark us out as a group selected for exploitation and oppression. It has been often done in history before, and you know about that. You know how groups have been singled out that must be used and, if necessary, liquidated. The Yellow Star of David, the Red Star for the Communists, the Pink Triangle for the Homosexual, the swastika painted on the wall, or on the wall, Paki, go home, have been used to single out and create this other, to discipline and punish, to exploit and silence. So we are conferred visibility in order to signal invisibility in the interstices of the settler colonial and imperialist state. Now, so the sexual images that do exist of us at all are of absolute degradation and of humiliation and this includes imageries of sadistic sexual degradation as much as one of general passivity. We are, however, spared the task of selling products because our faces do not sell products. When, you know, a product is sold by saying Indians use it, Tupacis use them, no one wants to buy them. So that part we are, you know, exempt from doing. But in tourism, in the images of the third world woman, you find that there is a product we can sell. We can sell fantasies, we can sell dreams of escape by using our faces, or their using of our faces in their work. Now, the images that do generally exist about us in your media here, and in the newspapers, and so I mean in the subway advertisements and so on, are of poverty, dirt, squalor, overpopulation, and occasional exoticism. The abundance of images that do exist about us are products of years of primitive accumulation, of pillage, plunder, slavery, and wage slavery. They are the images of the mind of racism that has been diffused into a common sense status and can be called into action. That well-aimed spit, that whistling beer bottle, that hurled insult on the street are all a part of this common sense world, as much as the enforced absence from intellectual and cultural production. The sexual images follow the path of these social images. We're passive, submissive, docile, doll-like creatures of men, totally bullyable, and then again contradictorily over-sexualized, and yet obedient little geisha girls, and unpolitical certainly. The myth of motherhood of the holy family in our case has been replaced by the myth of unending animal-like fecundity. No glamour exists in our motherhood, but this breeding capacity as animals. These are the images of ascription and prescription, and they are not retrievable or redeemable because they solely originate in the domain of oppression. So what most importantly, what must be remembered about us is that it is not the ads or commercials or in regular numbers of pornography magazines that our basic commoditization occurs. It is not even that one remove level, but actually, physically, in our own persons, in our own everyday life. When people themselves can be commanded to become images, to become walking things or silent forms, decontextualized from their history, it is the everyday practice that overdetermines the image and commands us to be commodities. We are the commodity. We do not have to have an image to be commoditized. The images that such as they are, do have effects on us. And the worst effect it has is that it kills not only what is being designated as sexuality only, but it kills all of our relationship at times to relate to the world. However, we have to allow this to make us resist it, because wherever there's oppression, there is an attempt to resist, simply not only to do politics on the street, but to survive at the everyday life. So people do try to remain active, open, and required that they do become subjects of their own action and not objects in and off of this society. We continuously struggle to gain, retain, and affirm our subject status, which means an authentic existence centered in desire. Desire in the sense in which I defined earlier. This desire is for us a direct and affirmative